Hey there, and welcome to The Jeffrey Van Dyke Show, a podcast for paradigm changers. Each week, I speak with another influential leader who's changing the conversation for their audience, their industry, and this world. I am so glad you're here. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and welcome to the show, my friends. Today, we have with us John Wolfstone. John is a wilderness rites of passage guide and transmedia activist. He lives in Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. This is a cool guy. I enjoyed this conversation and it went places I didn't know it would go. He does work around adult initiation, rites of passage in the modern context. And we talk a lot about what that means and how we can bring rites of passage tools to navigating life, especially when life gets, you know, when the rug gets pulled out from underneath us, when we can't make sense of what's going on, when life changes and we need to change with it, but don't know how. I believe this conversation will give you some insights, some tools, some ways to navigate that both personally and to look at how we can do that collectively, because we are certainly going through a huge rite of passage in humanity at this time. In 2015, John founded Reculture Media, which this summer is launching their first feature-length documentary about the work of Tamara Healing Biotope in Portugal, which is one of the Earth's most radical social experiments in future humanism. We talk a lot about how they move from an initial hippie commune into now one of the most successful experiments in an eco-village, how we talk about that today, and what they're doing around the world to teach people about creating spaces of trust, vulnerability, and relationship that can help us heal and grow together. He consults, creates, collaborates internationally. And my favorite part of about his bio, he says, remembering himself back into kinship with the earth at each step of the way. And I am sure that that is true. So I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome. Awesome. Welcome, John. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
For those of those folks who are listening versus watching, where are you right now?
I'm on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, which is a small Gulf island, which is nestled between Vancouver Island and like Vancouver City mainland, BC.
Right on. Gorgeous. Those of you who can't see, John's like outside next to his cabin. He's got, you know, a big stick next to him looking out at the ocean. So awesome. Here I am in LA. It's great. Here's where I want to start. So your work is about adult initiation as a kind of big picture thing. Yes. There's a number of places I want to go. I want to talk about adult initiation. I want to talk about cultural redemption. You've got a film, Love School, about this community, Tamara. So I want to learn about that and what Tamara has to teach the rest of us. I want to learn about kind of your journey into this and especially this word, the word redemption really stuck out to me in my research about you and getting prepared for this conversation. And culture redemption in relationship to personal redemption and all that good stuff. So let's start here. Tell us about adult initiation and then I want to get to Tamara here in just a minute in the film.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's actually feeling a bit almost teary. You know, there's just something about tuning in to the depth of what we're talking about and what it means for me personally and what I feel it means for us collectively that really gets me emotional. So just presencing that, because I feel so much of this work is in that slowing down and coming back into our feeling as human beings. And you could say that adulthood initiation, you know, it's many things, and I'll try to, you know, sum it up or explain it in a quick way. But you could say at some level, it is about waking us up again as emotional, feeling, breathing, interconnected beings. And that in traditional and indigenous cultures around the world, especially prior to this era of colonization that's pretty much uprooted most cultures across the planet, the fundaments of healthy culture were built from rites of passage. And rites of passage as a broader kind of area in which adulthood initiation is but one, is essentially how a culture helps human beings transition from one life stage to the next life stage. And it's pretty easy, I think, in our culture to see this around the age of like puberty. Right. It's like no news to anybody that a kid drastically changes when they turn 12 or 13. And many cultures have an actual cultural force that meets that moment to assist that. Because the idea was that without the assistance or the support or the container of culture, it's really hard, because these rites of passage actually, at their essence, are really about a death and rebirth of one's personal identity to take on new roles and responsibilities within the culture. So, for instance, I'm Jewish, and at 13, I had a bar mitzvah. You know, and right now, in an era of a very unredeemed and broken culture, it didn't really actually do much to prepare me to be an adolescent. But ideally, it would have done a lot to help me with that drastic shift. And my teenage years were actually very hard, as they are for many, because there wasn't much preparation or holding or anchoring or mentorship. So adulthood initiation is the focus of my work because, you know, if you look out, Jeffrey, at the world that we have, you could at one level look at it as a culture stuck in adolescence. We live in a culture that is essentially addicted to infinite growth and is addicted to a certain sense of ego gratification at a cultural level, which is actually very healthy and normal for an adolescent person. In the adolescent phase of our lives, when we are teenage years, we're totally in this time of trying out different like ego identities, which is why you're like, I want to be a jock, then I want to be a goth, then I want to buy these other identities. The problem is, as culture broke down, we as a collective humanity and most of the like cultures, quote unquote, that we live in now got stuck there. But the thing is, to become a real adult human being isn't just, oh, I turn 18 and now I can vote or go to war or drink alcohol. There's actually a really deep psychological shift that needs to happen that also is mirrored by a different sense of like a new place in your culture. And cultures around the world, like almost every culture on planet Earth since the beginning of time or human time, had these adulthood initiations where the primary goal was to essentially help that adolescent ego-centered part of us, you could say, shed or die, so that a adult part, which is fundamented by your own, I guess, the way I really love to say it is, this actually comes from eco-psychologist Bill Plotkin, it's the shift from an ego-centric worldview to an eco, as an ecological-centric worldview, meaning you shift from the sense of like separation in the world's about me, I, to the inner like sense that I am an interconnected being, and the purpose of my life is to be of service, and to be of service from a deeply rooted place of soul. And by soul, we mean like really doing the work to connect to one's own deepest gifts, which are often born of our wounds, so that we can serve culture from the place of like us fulfilling our purpose. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
One of the things it does, one of the things you said is it's about connecting people to their purpose in community. And I really appreciated that, because so often I think when we ask, what's my purpose? In this context, we could say it's an adolescent question, in that we're saying it's all about me, my purpose, my utility, versus connecting people to their purpose in community. How do I relate to the larger thing and contribute to it? You know, one of the things I know you talked about is intentional initiation. And what it made me think about is unintentional initiation or intention, you know, initiation that we didn't necessarily want or design. It just happened. You know, maybe it's a huge accident or something else that puts us on a path. And, you know, started by talking about our cultures not having initiations anymore and being stuck in adolescence. what that makes me think of is, oh, is are we right now in an unconscious or unintentional initiation collectively?
Yes. Yes. 100%. And I think to help frame that, I also want to say that initiation in general and the adulthood initiation journey is really about facing one's own death, which is why when it's not intentionally done culturally, that energy typically still finds us in like life, and it happens in very unintentional, often very harmful ways, sometimes including death, because something happens when humans, being mortal creatures, knowing that we all will die, when we actually encounter that and like essentially psychologically, culturally process that, that is what frees us from this ego trap of my, and allows us to actually live a place of service, because we are connected. Because when we face our own death, and actually we live in a very death phobic culture at large right now in the US and really the now like global, like transcultural world that we live in. So bringing this to a collective level, right now we are in a conglomeration of mega crisis. And where that really roots down for me, it's not so much about climate change or these other little points. It's really about extinction. We are causing like 1,000 species a year to go extinct. And actually looking at some of the best science that I have, the possibility of human extinction is very real. It's very on the table. And you could say at a collective level, we are facing the possibility of our own species death. And that is the unintentional consequence of us not being initiated. So the earth is doing it for us, because anytime one level of system doesn't self-regulate, a higher level system is going to self-regulate. So the earth, you know, with climate change and all of these things that are happening, is just self-regulating because we aren't. But to go through a real initiatory process, which maybe now we are in, would require us to actually step into that capacity to self-regulate. And so you can see how maybe we're going to make it through, and this is exactly the initiation that we like need, but we need to also meet it, because the thing is, in healthy culture, this death energy comes, and cultures would meet that with their own force to essentially kind of like tame it or balance it. And that's why initiations were often, you know, very intense and very dangerous, but they were culturally constructed to have the culture keep living, because those cultures knew, indigenous people know, if you do not initiate people into adulthood, into the culture, really, you actually become a true cultural member. You become a true part of the community when you pass through this initiation, that without doing that, their culture wouldn't survive. Yeah. Which is why this is at the center of their culture.
A lot of, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that a lot of initiations from indigenous cultures are really about, you know, facing death to mature oneself to handle power appropriately.
Yes, 100%. Because that power needs to be rooted in one, the fact that really you have no power. At the end of the day, death is the, and we live in a culture right now that very much is about consent and this like healing of consent, but death is unconsensual. You don't get to choose whether you die or like not. It comes for you often at the moment you're not wanting it to. So one, that humility, I think, puts a certain like regulatory capacity in your capacity to handle power. And two, you become bound because you realize you are mortal. Your own sense of self starts to expand or widen beyond just this body. And hopefully, in a successful initiatory process, you actually psychologically mature to understand that you are the interconnection between all like life, which is just actually a fact of like life. Like that actually is how it is. It's just we get so caught up in like this, my body is me. So when you are grounded in that sense of identity, that I am the interrelationship between much more than just me, it becomes inherent that you use your power, your capacity as this body and mind and creature to be in service to all these other parts because they also are like you. So I think that many people think, oh, you become very like disciplined or your heart gets so like big. And it's not any of these like heroic efforts. It's just that you fundamentally operate from the place that you are everything else. If I'm doing something in power that's harming somebody else, that's also harming me. So I just wouldn't do that anymore.
So I want to ask you a bit, you know, if somebody's listening to this, and in just a minute, I want to get to this Tamara and the film and what that might have to teach us about all this. But before we go there at a collective level, I just want to ask, are there particular life phases where you see adults could really use initiations, right? Like, God, I know when my dad left his job, right, after 25 years of working at the same place, like that was a tough thing. You know, are there particular phases of life where we could use initiations, and how might we design our own initiations? Or what, like if we go, I need an initiation here. How does one go about creating an initiation?
Yeah. Thank you. You know, so I'd say that really, you know, what you're calling, I would call all of this like rites of passage, in general. There is like certain life stage ones, but anytime there's a major transition, you could call it a rite of passage. When you move, when your parent dies or a loved one dies, when you get in a bad accident, these are all fundamentally, like, let's just say they are fundamentally psychologically transformative events.
Yeah.
And the like,
let me maybe just add this, based on something else you were sharing. They're all opportunities to question our sense of who we are. They all shake our sense of identity, and they all require the formation of a new identity to meet the new phase of life.
Yes. And in this, so in transitions is when our belonging, our identity comes most in question. Unheld, often this causes trauma, and it causes a great sense of like disillusionment and lostness. But when these transitions are well held, which is essentially the difference between an unintentional and an intentional initiation, our belonging, our sense of identity just goes deeper, just gets more secure at some level. So instead of becoming, and again, because this is a like transition, there is a moment of insecurity, but it being held, which is what you're asking of, like, how do we go about doing this? So one of the fundamental things, and this will link to the question of Tamara, is that we need to be anchored by other people. And by anchored, I mean we need to, again, be willing to be held and cared for and witnessed. Like, maybe the most important part of a initiation from a cultural level is that there is a group of people, you know, whether that be your family, your friends, your partner, but hopefully more than just one or two, that are holding you, witnessing you, and saying, hey, I see you. I see where you're in, and I'm helping you. I'm holding you, giving you some, like, bumper rails so that you just don't go off the, like, deep end. And I'm going to see you and witness you as you get to the, like, other side of whatever this hard transitionary moment is. So a very simple way to do that, say I know I'm quitting my job or I lost my job, the first thing I do and what I teach often is how do you do some sort of story share where you call together your friends and family and you maybe have a fire or you make a nice meal and you simply share your story, like vulnerably, what is really going on for you, what is hard, what are you feeling, what it, all the like things. And it's profound. This is so simple, but we rarely do it. And every human being has such a deep longing and need to be seen and witnessed. And this just at first creates that bit of holding. And I would do that at the start. And again, at the end, once you kind of make it to like the next job or the next life phase or the, you know, the new place that you like move. So that's one maybe very basic, accessible way. People, there's much more than like that. I can say maybe one other thing I will say is that a healthy, a redeemed culture, because you asked about cultural redemption, is a culture of mentorship, meaning that hopefully in this process of inviting people into your life to hold you and anchor you, you're also maybe formalizing over time relationship with mentors, which you could say maybe the business world is like your own personal board of directors. So like, for instance, Jeffrey, you know, you're somebody maybe 10, 15, 20 years older than like me. I could, after this interview, reach out and be like, Jeffrey, that was so great. I wonder if something we could just talk and I could share a bit about my like life and you could give me feedback and catch my like story. And like, it's that sort of relationship that makes me feel more secure and grounded just in general in my like life. And I have about 10 different mentors I talk to, sometimes once a month, sometimes once a like year, but they're people that are checking in on me and are invested in my success. And each person, we can create that for ourselves. In a time of so much disconnection, it is such a profound act to get people actually invested in our lives. And often all it takes is just inviting it or asking for it.
I love that you share that. I have a friend, Shasta Nelson, who has a community, a big community called Girlfriend Circles. And you know, years ago, she started this. And she's a real expert on developing friendships with other women, like women with women. You know, and a lot of the people that will be a part of that community will say, why is it that when I go out with my girlfriends, it's all superficial, but when I'm over here, we have some depth, right? And so I'm hearing a couple of things there. One, the intentional container is part of what creates a space for some depth. Of course, having people that actually can see you be witnesses for you. Oftentimes, I think we try to get feedback from people who can't actually see us, right? So, you know, having people that we trust, that we respect, that can see us. And I would say for anybody listening, if you don't have those people, to make an intent to cultivate those relationships, find them someplace in your life. When I turned 40, I had just moved to LA, and a friend of mine last minute threw me a birthday party at their house, and it was 10 dear friends, all of whom are up to amazing things in the world. And they went around the table and they just said, here's what I see in you and here's what I see for you this coming year.
Yes.
Right. And a big part of my wounding in life is feeling like I don't belong. And I'll never forget driving home that night. I can't remember what each person said, but I distinctly had the feeling in my body, like, these people care about me. They know me. They want to see my best in the world. They're invested in that, right? And that I had a place in the world as a result of it. My inner guidance as I was driving along then chimed in and said, yeah, Jeffrey, your people are edge riders. And if you're holding back on the wave, sitting back here, surfing analogy, right? You look to your left and right, nobody's there. But if you're where you're meant to be among these other edge riders, you're going to look left and right and you're going to find your people, right? You're going to find your community. Yep. And that sense of belonging emerged. But like you said, sometimes it can be a dinner, but an intentional act at a dinner, because we all know we can just hang out and, right? But like to say to people like, hey, I'm having a big transition in life. I'd like some reflection in what you see in my experience and who I am and where I'm going.
Right. And you know what this actually brings to mind with the dinner example, just to further a bit how we create initiations for ourselves, is really also what I call the power of ritual. To talk about cultural redemption, like learning again that we are ritual beings inherently, as human beings, as a natural like way that we are in the world, is so important. And what I mean by that is this capacity to create intentional space. So it's a really simple example that I think most people could understand. It's very kind of common, you know, in certain circles, and definitely like going back in time, that you would say something at a dinner table before you eat by way of acknowledging the food or being grateful or just acknowledging the moment, right? And in most modern families, at least the modern family I grew up in, my parents, my family could not handle a moment because if to them it felt maybe awkward, like their own sense of not belonging couldn't handle creating some intentionality. Maybe it was too encapsulated in a like some kind of religious view. But it's even that capacity. Like, hey, we are now going to ritually mark that we were doing other like things, and now we're just marking for a moment that we're going to now eat and put something into our body, which is a really actually, even though we do it every single day, it's a really sacred act. Maybe we're doing it with other people as well. So it's the same thing. Same having a birthday party. It's like, hey, I want to actually mark this birthday by having you all here and actually having an intentional space to have you all share. Or say that it's like I'm transitioning a job. Maybe I have a fire. And this is a very simple one. I'm going to burn some things I want to let go of and then put some intentions into the fire. But it's this process of marking one thing to another thing in that, quote, ritual action that helps our psyche kind of catch up to the changes that we are already in.
I appreciate you sharing that, because so often I think what happens is we enter into an initiation that we don't know we're in, right? It's not intentional. It happens to us. Sometimes it's a big kaboom thing in our life, but oftentimes not.
Yep.
And there's a dissolving of what's been, and what will be hasn't yet shown up. And we're in this in-between space, right? Yep. You know, sometimes we call it liminal space, the space between spaces. Yep. And I think, you know, the purpose of liminal spaces is in one hand to teach us trust, to teach us surrender. We have to slow down in liminal space. But what you're saying about this intentionality and even demarking from one world to another, I think can help bridge us and carry us across liminal space from one part of our life to another. Let's talk a little bit about... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, maybe just one thing on liminal space. This is so important because we are in a very liminal time. I mean, geez, with COVID, but even beyond that. And the thing is, the purpose of liminal space, this is really key, is in a liminal space. Think about like Halloween, it's a very liminal time of year. It is that capacity for accessing to the, quote, other world, the world where creativity, where imagination, where inspiration, where vision comes from. Mm-hmm. And in a, for instance, adulthood initiation, you know, you could say it in a more like Western way, it's about finding your purpose. But in a more traditional culture, it's about encountering the vision for your life. And where does that vision come from? This is the key thing. It doesn't come from you. It comes from your capacity to actually go into that liminal place and not just freak out because it's so uncertain. And this is, again, why that marking helps you feel safe. And I know I'm going to get to the other side, so I can rest in this liminal space and I can actually start to have a conversation with like my muse or my soul or whatever words, so many words, the great mystery people want to put on it. But for me, an initiated adult is somebody that knows how to have that conversation and create those spaces to keep having that conversation. Because all the great people say it, the greatness doesn't come from them.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's making me think of one other story, John. This past summer, there was a program I'd run for some time, and, you know, I had a whole Facebook ad funnel. I was about to start a new ad funnel. And I mean, we had designed the whole thing, all the videos, all the collateral, et cetera. It was literally this Friday where I was supposed to give the green light to start turning on the ad spend. And my business manager just looked at me and she's like, "You don't want to do this, do you?" Mm. And I was like, "No." It's like, you don't have any interest in this, do you? Like, no. It was part of the business model I was familiar with and we've had for a while, and it's how I knew how to run that part of my business. She's like, "Why don't you just not do it?" You know, I was like, well, what if blah. But I also run my life by this philosophy that, like, go where the life force is, because that's always, yes, you know, where life starts working. So I had never even, yes. So that night, my partner and I, we grilled out and sat out in our back patio and had a really nice meal. And I said, "Hey, I'm about to make this decision to, like, you know, throw this part of my business out the window. And I don't know what that's going to mean, you know, and I don't know what it's going to mean financially for the business and so forth. And, you know, he just looked at me. He's like, look, if this is what you need to do, do it. We'll be fine. We'll figure it out. You know, I trust you. And if you need to do this, do it. I had never, until this moment, even seen that as an initiation. But it was, because it was a part of me recognizing this part of my life is done. And I'm about to move into another arena. And I don't know what that's going to mean. And to have people in my life, and this story is just two, right? But in one day, to have these people in my life witness me, to recognize me, to say, hey, we're here with you. You're okay. We've got your back. And it's their commitment to me that gave me the safety to risk stepping out into the next thing. So, you know, this piece of being witnessed and held in the liminal space, where I love you sharing, like, the point is to go into, you know, to cross the veil, if you will, into the place.
Yeah.
Where we can step into another world, into another land, into another vision, another possibility for our own lives. And then to come back and start to integrate, well, what the hell does that all mean? And structurally, how will that change what I do and who I am and how I show up in the world? You know, and then start to actually make those changes. Like, if we're not held, the ability to risk going there can be pretty challenging. Let's move to kind of the bigger picture of our world, and we'll talk about Tamara and Love School. But the big question I have in my mind is, like, we can talk about this stuff, and I see it for the individual, and I can see how to help people create even small rituals, and small initiations, you know, or simple, maybe small is the wrong word. But when I think about our whole world, like, how do we collectively go into the vision space? You know, how do we collectively move into this liminal space we're in and use it for what it's designed for, which is for us to access the vision for a new story for humanity and start living that new story. So tell us a little bit about, I have a sense that Tamara and this film Love School has maybe some answers for that or some ways into this. So start by telling us what Tamara is.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you for bringing this in. So, you know, I can maybe share a bit the story of Tamara, which is, you know, we're not the first generation to recognize that things are a bit awry on planet Earth, and that, you know, some kind of great revolution is needed. And, you know, this happened really, maybe not for the first time, but a big time in the 1960s. You know, there was a huge cultural renaissance. And in that time, people then, similar to also what's happening now, got that, like, this actually isn't just like a surface level shift. This has to be like a fundamental shift of the way human beings relate to each other and the planet. And people tried to stabilize that, like, understanding through creating new structures of living, which essentially became this back to the land hippie commune movement. You know, and again, this is like the first wave of people doing it. So there was a lot they didn't know, tons of mistakes. And most of these hippie communes, which at one point, I think there were like thousands, tens of thousands across the US and Europe and probably in other parts of the world as well. And nearly all of them failed. And you could say they failed because, you know, the greater culture wasn't ready, but you could say they also failed because human beings coming back to live in community touches us back in with a really, really deep, old hurt that we all once used to belong and live in tribe, live in village, live in community. And essentially, at some level, that is the way human beings were designed for, like, 98% of our human history. You know, the last 6,000 years of agriculture and, like, empires and city-states is a quite short anomaly, and still is like, does that actually even work? And what Tamara figured out is that when human beings come back together in community, there's a lot of pain from that very old hurt that is awakened, and that unless that pain is given space transparently within the community to be talked about, to be understood, to be processed. Again, like the very thing you were talking about with your partner and your business partner witnessing you, Tamara's like, oh, we need to actually create community where this is the basis of what we do in community. And by doing that, by creating essentially this word transparency is really big, they were able to heal their way through all of the like power dynamics and essentially human drama that typically is what crashed most of these community experiments. And so they evolved and grew for the last 40 years till now, where they are one of the most longstanding and successful Echo Village. That's kind of like the new way we call
a hippie commune.
hippie commune, yep. Projects in the world, and they've become a world leader on like water retention landscapes, on teaching community, on like agroforestry, and also on this very deep level of how you actually build community. And the last part that maybe is most controversial and interesting about Tamara is that they also understood that this pain in humanity, and you could say maybe our shadow, plays out in this realm of love and sexuality. And, you know, look all over the news, especially since the era of Me Too, that this especially sexual shadow for human beings is so great that so many gurus and executives and et cetera fall to really shadowy, painful, hurtful dynamics. And the key to this is that there's a lack of integration between this basic life force impulse and our capacity in a single human being or collective of human beings to hold this at this time. And because it's so not integrated or not transparent, it goes into the shadow and causes harm behind the scenes. So Tamara's like, okay, this is here. Let's put this in the center and talk about it. And they just did that over and over. And I mean, the first time going to Tamara, I saw, it's like a circle of 100 people. I saw a man get up, walk into the center of this circle of people, and he's like this older guy, he's kind of overweight. He wasn't necessarily your typical like Clint Eastwood. And he just very vulnerably was like, I have a crush and a sexual longing for this beautiful woman over like here. And he just shared and poured his heart out. And, you know, the people who were kind of holding this circle kind of even brought it back to like deeper issues of how he'd been rejected earlier in his life. And he got to share it to the point of being in tears. And then everybody clapped and just like essentially witnessed him and congratulated him on his like vulnerability. And that was it. It wasn't like a drama. It wasn't that he wasn't even like necessarily like directly making some pass on this woman. He was just being honest about what was true in him. And then that honesty could be held by every. So instead of him maybe late at night at the bar putting some weird move on this younger, beautiful woman, he could just vulnerably share it. And maybe he didn't even have to act it out at all.
Right.
It was just he needed to be seen in it, and he needed to not hide this truth, this uncomfortable truth that was in him. And that's kind of the basis for what that community does and why they work.
I love it. It reminds me years ago, Debbie Ford, who does a lot, you know, is now deceased, but did a lot of work in bringing shadow work to mainstream. I told the story about her young son who came home from school. And I said, Mom, everybody said I was stupid. The boys at school called me stupid. And she said to him, you are stupid, honey. And he goes, wait, what? He's like, yeah. Haven't you done anything that's stupid? Well, yeah, I guess. All right. Have I done anything stupid? Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yes, you have. All right. Were the boys calling you stupid? Stupid? Yeah. All right. Great. So you're stupid. I'm stupid. They're stupid. You know, are you also brilliant? Are you also smart? Yeah. 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 Right. And to me, it was such a great example of nothing has to be off limits. Like stupid can be in the mix. Right. And so can brilliance. And what I'm hearing in that example is, if crushing out on this younger girl doesn't have to stay hidden and in the shadow, it takes the zing out of it, takes the energy out of it, right? And it just allows it to be okay. So I know Tamara, you were part of creating a film about Tamara called Love School. And I know Tamara does a lot of work on kind of educating humanity. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, and I'd say that this is a difficult point about Tamara, and I think somewhere that they are learning, because it's this fundamental thing of like they figured something out, and they figured something out big. Like essentially what they figured out is how to build trust again amongst human beings. And I think they're encountering how do they share that message without proselytizing or saying like we have the answer. But what is true is that there is pretty basic patterns, psychological, cultural patterns underlying most human beings of like jealousy, fear, this basic emotional construct that we have that starts to play out in a variety of interesting ways when we're starting to actually live with and relate with other human beings. And they essentially like figured out like how do we deal with these constructs, these psychological constructs that we live in, and build trust again amongst human beings so that we actually have the capacity to imagine structuring society in a fundamentally different way, where this opens up the possibilities for humans to work, live, play, and love together in a way where we're not so separate. Because I don't care whatever solutions we can talk about right now to the global crisis, maybe at the core of all of them is the capacity for human beings to collaborate, to work together, and possibly even live. And I think Tamara's big thing they do teach is like, how do we actually live in community? Because I want to say that like, it is just more efficient. Besides all the benefits of like social, emotional health, of being able to feel belonging to a group of people, or like I have many friends trying to like have kids or not having kids because they're like, two people are just not enough to have a kid. Kids are wild. They're talking about a force of just energy. And it's like, that's why people lived in villages and extended families. It just makes sense on so many levels, but people don't do it because of the drama, because of the pain, because they don't like the people. They haven't figured out how to actually build trust that more people doesn't become like a threat, which is what we all have to work through, because there is that part of all of us that sees a human being. If like we don't have the trust, they could be a potential threat. So Tamara's trying to educate, how do we actually build that trust? And that has to get beyond the place of like, I'm right, you're wrong, or he's bad. It's like, hey, we all are a little stupid, a little shameful. We've all lied. We've all hurt people. We've all been hurt. And can we see that really it's the hurts we are carrying is why we hurt other people? And if we can create a space to share that hurt and recognize it's a collective hurt, it kind of takes that zing out of it being such my big personal issue, and it allows us to start solving the problem on a more collective level, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Years ago, I was leading some trainings in Colombia and was talking with one of the guys who brokered the peace deal with the FARC, which was the guerrillas, you know, that were in the jungles for 50 years. And he said, we had mothers and grandmothers write letters to their children, grandchildren, some of whom they'd never met because it was born in the jungles. And he said, we literally floated them down the river in bottles in the jungle. And these gorillas got these letters from somebody's mom, from somebody's grandmother, right? And it was part of building trust, building relationship, to start a dialogue, which eventually led to peace, right? We were doing a day, I was facilitating a day on the core wounds of the country. And what we ended up with is that, like, people fundamentally not feeling heard. And that's actually why he told me the story. He's like, oh, funny, because this is a key part of how we broker the peace deal, having people be heard. It strikes me too that I just keep getting this feeling like what Tamara's doing. You didn't say this, but what I feel is like it's about solving loneliness, which is related to belonging, right?
It is 100%.
Trust being a part of that.
100%.
So, John,
because you can be around other people and still be lonely, and trust is the thing that makes you be not lonely, because then you can build real intimacy. Because it's intimacy, I think, we're all longing for with other people. And how many of us work in like work environments, but we don't feel intimate at all. We have not cracked that layer of vulnerability or trust. So that there's a big shift there of not just being around other people, but really deeply connecting to other people, where that loneliness actually is no longer there.
Yeah. What is, you know, on Tamara's website, it says, The Birth, Terra Nova, A World Beyond War, by building healing biopes, futuristic centers that research and model a new planetary culture. Tamara empowers people around the world to build regenerative, nonviolent culture through research, education, and outreach. I'm curious, how are they doing outreach? And like, having now created a film about them, and maybe this will be hard for you to answer publicly, but like, how effective do you feel like they're being at it? The outreach piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is, again, a healing biotope is their model for essentially a like regenerative eco-village cultural center. And the key of it is, and this gets back to, I think this is a really important point, is that it's meant to be a place free of contradiction. It means this is where trust is broken, right? It's like you have this guru who's talking love and light and peace, and he goes and sleeps with like 20 of his like women in an unconsensual way, whatever, right? That's like a big contradiction. So what they're creating, this is essentially a future. They want to create a future without war, which I, as a vision, believe in deeply. I don't think we have to war. I think we actually are intelligent enough, and we could figure it out on a collective level, how not to have to go to war to solve our problems. For me, it's actually like, of course. But it's like, okay, so how do we actually do that? And for them, it's these healing biotopes become essentially human greenhouses of trust that they call them. And the way they're trying to essentially share this information, one, they've created, I guess, partnership or sister centers in crisis areas across the world. So they actually have a peace village in Colombia in that similar region where they've been doing work for like 20 years. So they've gone into many crisis areas because they believe like, hey, if we can show that this is possible in Israel, Palestine, in the jungles of Colombia, you know, in various parts of Latin America where there's been war for a very, very long time, like we can show this is possible anywhere. So they have about, you know, they have a project in the favelas or slums of Sao Paulo, Brazil. So they're showing that peace is, one, possible, even in the wildest of human circumstances. And then they really have their center in Portugal as an education center. So when I started going there, I was going there amongst many different world leaders that they kind of courted to try to come in and give this deep peace research knowledge too. And they do have a like media arm where they're trying to get their message out. And the benefit of having filmmakers like me come in is that we have a bit more of an objective view. And the thing is, Tamara is not perfect. They have many mistakes, many places they're figuring out. But the difference between them and most other places is that it's about feedback loops, Jeffrey, like that process of that man, because the thing is, what I didn't say about that man, the story of that man, in that social process they have, which they call forum, people step in the middle and share, and then other people afterwards come up and give very direct, clear feedback, which is amazing. That process of feedback is how we evolve. So Tamara is not just like, this is how we are, and this is how we're going to be, and this is the way. They're like, hey, we're open to your feedback, because we understand feedback is how we like grow. And it's very vulnerable for people in positions of power, especially because it can threaten your power. But feedback loops are what, that's how nature works. Nature's in a constant feedback loop of itself. So their whole premise is, let's create feedback loops again in the human system, which means actually that there is no consistent hierarchy, which means you have to be willing that maybe you're the leader for that moment, and maybe somebody is just in a better moment to be leading next. And the willingness for like that is what allows their system to stay healthy, to stay regenerative, to be a bit more redeemed, because it is actually alive again, meaning it has the capacity to also for like death. They're willing to put that identity down or that thought down. And same, human beings stay healthy when we are willing to let our beliefs be challenged, go through those initiatory processes again and again. So you can say Tamaras is in a kind of constant evolutionary state where they welcome the initiations when they come.
Beautiful. I dig it. Before we close, I want to hear about your journey into initiation.
Yeah.
Your journey into this work. Like, what drew you to it? What were the wounds that put you on this path? How did you end up here?
Great. Yeah. I can start when I was 26, I was living in San Francisco, which we're talking about, I think, prior. They used to also live there. And, you know, as a young professional, I felt like I had made it. I had this amazing job teaching filmmaking to at-risk youth at a nonprofit. I lived in an art collective. I was doing like wilderness, yoga, backpacking, retreats on the side. And in my center, though, I felt hollow because what I saw was a world around me that was in crisis. And I didn't understand at all how really what I was doing was going to at all impact that on enough of a like level that I wasn't just going to go down with the rest of the like world. And then I came across, like, I guess, a group of people that were on about this concept of initiation. And in that concept, it was like, oh, at about this age, 26, 27, people in most traditional cultures would go through an initiatory process. And part of that process would be connecting to their deepest soul gift or purpose or like vision for their own life. And as soon as I heard this, I was like, this is it. Like, if this is true, nothing else matters. And I also saw people in my office being 10, 15 years down the like road, and they just looked so miserable. I was like, I don't want to be 50 waking up going to this office. It's like, I feel like I creeped over the walls of society and looked into what it had to offer. And I was like, fuck this. And so I left. I created a big severance, which is part. So the typical initiatory process is severance, threshold into that liminal place, and return. I left my life, and I pointed my car east. And I ended up bicycling from Colorado to Montana. I spent a month in the wilderness of Alaska. I went on my first four-day vision quest of seven in the deserts of Utah before I went to the Middle East to take a one-way trip to Israel, because I'm Jewish and wanted to explore that land. And I essentially went on like an eight-year, very synchronistically led, like very guided journey of being led through the deepest gates of my personal and collective wounds into places. And this is where I met Tamara, and this is where all the vision for my life came. And I could say this journey for me in some ways, like my rite of passage ended 2 years ago when my mother unexpectedly died. I had just moved up here, and I was up here to start a community project. I was essentially trying to create a Tamara-like place center here in BC. And one day I woke up, and I got a phone call from my dad that my mother had something to happen in the middle of the night. There had been some kind of like home accident, and she was dead. It's like the most, you know, horrible thing you kind of think about, maybe one day will happen. And it happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, say most of us, it's not probably news to people, but you know, your wounds probably come from your parents. And my mother had a very hard life herself, and our relationship was very unrequited, unresolved. And there was just a lot of pain there. And I had to go home and really face that and put my mother in the ground and face kind of the grief and also the love. Like really, Jeffrey, what I felt in that final kind of rite of passage initiatory experience of my mother unexpectedly dying was she did make a lot of mistakes as a mom, but she also really loved me, as any mother does, even the, quote, most traumatized, wounded mothers do. And in her death, I got to feel for the first time all that love that she'd been trying to give me my whole life, but she was too locked up in her own pain to like do. And I heard it through the stories of everybody else about who this woman was. This person became this like enigma. You know, it happens often in death. You find out this whole other side to people, that you, and especially parent. So since then, I've really been on this journey of like reclamating the love of my mother. And you could say at some level, you look at planet like Earth, you could say we're all in this story of like a wounded mother, where we feel some kind of wounding from this great mother of planet Earth. And in tow, we are hurting her like back. And there's something unredeemed or unresolved there. So in that way, I've also want to say something I haven't mentioned a lot is that I have found, and I think this is a big part of the cultural moment of healing we're in, a lot of that like mother wound healing through deeply connecting to the earth. Because at the end of the day, the earth is what holds me. It's what holds all of us. And it wants so much intimacy, and the earth is so sensual and alive and is just waiting for us. And you were telling me about the coyotes and the cougar that was in like in that like neighborhood where you live. And this is the root of the truest, deepest belonging. And I found when I was so deeply in grief because my human mother was gone, she had died, I found that solace. I found that like holding the loving mother's arms in the like earth. And of like if anything of everything I've shared today that I love for people to walk away with, it is like it really starts with us reconnecting to the earth and then reconnecting as human beings to each other as being part of the earth.
I have a question for you. So yeah. You're obviously not the only person to say that, and it's a conversation I think we hear a lot if we're in conscious circles and so forth. But I think sometimes people wonder, like, what the hell does that actually mean? Does that mean, like, going on walks? Does that mean going to the ocean? Does it mean, like, hugging a tree? You know, like, what does that actually mean to reconnect with the earth?
Yeah, it's really, really deep, and it's not necessarily easy. Because we don't come from a culture that is earth. It's not, I mean, it's great. Go outside. Just go outside. Yes. First thing. But, you know, I've been privileged, and I found this also, to be part of, like, much of the education I've done is really deep mentorship, we talked about, of deep earth connection. I'm, like, a backwoods primitive skills, like, survival guide. And that was a lot of mentorship of, like, I can make fire from sticks and my like knife that I like found. But that it's not that everybody needs to go to that level of connection, but I think something a teacher of mine said to me once, this is I think speaking more to the like California New Age scene as well, is like you need to get functional with the earth before you get ceremonial. And for me, actually the thing I can recommend is work with fire, because fire is such an easy way to get in a tangible relationship of actual need. Because it isn't just like go on a walk, because the fundamental thing is we need the earth and we need to remember ourselves. Like even if you're using your iPhone, that all comes from the earth. It's a need that we have and we're so disconnected. So for me, learning again how to like make fires, sit by a fire, warm ourselves by a fire, cook over a fire, tell stories with your friends. We talked about stories in the beginning. By a fire, like fire is really the moment we human beings became human. You could say maybe that is the moment we stopped being primates and a lot shifted, which we could talk about around fire. So for me, it's learning to build a relationship with these elements. It's actually a needs-based thing, which is a difficult thing. And there's lots of ways to go about that, but it has to be just beyond you being a spectator.
Yeah. You know, what it's making me think of is I told you we bought this house in the Hollywood Hills a few years back, and we've been taking these classes at Theodore Payne, which is a gardening center that educates people about California native plants. So we've been doing all, you know, they're naturally drought tolerant, but the thing that's been so interesting to be a part of and to learn about and then be a part of is like, there are certain animals that will only come to your yard if you have these native plants, right?
Yes.
And if you have exotics from other countries, like, you won't get those animals to come to your yard. So even that, like, being a part of an ecosystem, being a part of creating an ecosystem, of nurturing an ecosystem, and having that ecosystem nurture us through something, you know, on some level as simple as gardening, but doing it in a way that is in relationship to something other than ourselves, and in relationship to this land we're on here in Los Angeles, you know, that actually has been part of me getting in touch with nature in a way I haven't before.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at the deepest level, this question for me hits upon what is the, like, ecological niche human beings actually fill on planet Earth. And at some level, you could say, like, we are the voice for the ecosystems that we live in. We have this capacity for language and creation at a far exceeding capacity than most creatures. And what I mean by that is that, like, that deep sense of belonging and connection and not being alone or loneliness we're talking about comes from you starting to relate with and starting to get to know the more than human world that lives right around you. And there's so many ways to learn that. You can become like your own backyard naturalist. You can learn the trees in your backyard, those birds that come to your bird feeder, and start to learn, like, what do they like? How can you start to tend the ecosystem that you are in? Because that tending of the ecosystem is what puts us back into it. And it's so fulfilling, Jeffrey. And it could be simple. I mean, just having a bird feeder for, like, me is such a joy. It's a very simple, very low-hanging fruit of a thing. And one of the practices I want to share is a practice called Sit Spot, which is just, it's simply, think of like meditation, but you're doing it outside and your eyes are open and you're allowed to be curious. It's a little bit easier, I'd say, than meditation. That's an active, you still are trying to be present and not lost in your thoughts, but you're actively allowing your curiosity just in that present moment to, like, oh, look at that tree and I wonder, like, why is it growing in that way? Or what is its bark doing? Or, like, look at that bird or look at this ant. And that's the way that children learn. Is let their, so just going outside for me, I spend 20 minutes or so every single morning sitting outside and just being with the natural environment, hearing the birds and getting curious and then allowing that curiosity to take me. Like, I'm going to go look up that bird I saw, the craziest red head, and I'm like, what is going on there? And just that curiosity, it's, again, it's not like some hard disciplined thing. We as organic creatures have curiosity for a reason. We just have to allow ourselves again to, like, invite it in.
I love it. John, I love this conversation. I love what you're up to in the world. Your story about leaving work and peering over society's wall, to me, on one hand, feels like, and I don't mean any offense by this, I actually mean it very purposefully, feels like a millennial story. Like, I feel like part of what the millennials came here to do is, like, F that, right. You know? So, yeah, I just love it. Where do we find more about you?
Yeah. So you can currently find me. My personal website is johnwolfstone.com. You can check out our film. You can go to loveschool.com. We're actually probably in the process of changing the title, but that site will always link you to the correct name and title. And you can also check out my media company for the wider works. Look up Reculture Films. RE Culture Films on YouTube.
Awesome.
Probably the Beautiful. Best three places.
Hey, this has been a rich conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here.
Jeffrey, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as well.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey there, thanks so much for listening in. If this conversation was powerful, if it stirred your soul or inspired your journey, then be sure to share it with a friend. Just copy and paste the link wherever you're listening to this podcast and text that link right now to a friend that you think would be inspired by this episode. And if this is your first time here, be sure to click that subscribe button over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a rating and review so I can get to know you and your thoughts better. To learn more about the work I do with emerging and established paradigm changers, go to thecourageousmessenger.com. That's all for today.
Thanks so much for being here, and I hope to see you in the next episode.